The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. I'm Anthony Skinner, producer of the show, and we want to congratulate Ian on the success of reaching 1 million downloads in less than a year. That's a really big deal, and we owe you all a big thanks for listening and sharing with your friends and family and making it all possible. And on that note as well, we'd like to give a shout out to a few of our Patreon supporters. Let me read a few of these names here. Eric Pace, Rachel Coleman, Erland Mowinkle, Casey and Sarah Barton, Denise Whitney, Andrea Peters, Joel Guptel, Rachel Emery, and Eugenie Taylor. Hey, all of your contributions are so greatly appreciated. Thank you. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Typology Podcast. That's at TYPOLOGYPODCAST. Be sure and stay connected with us there so we can fill you in on what podcasts are about to drop, when Ian might be speaking somewhere close to you, plus other goodies along the way. All right, now what you've all been waiting for, part two of our panel of fours. Be sure and stick around to the end when Ian and our guest pull some guitars down from the studio walls here and spontaneously break into a Dylan tune. It's pretty unforgettable, really cool. So let's pick back up in part two of our panel of fours with our host, Ian Cron.
When I'm teaching the Enneagram to large groups, I get to the end of it and I think to myself, golly, I made us sound like a bunch of really strange people who probably shouldn't be out in public too much and who probably are such a bummer. But I don't personally experience fours that way. There's a lot of love about fours, and there's plenty I love about being one, you know? So tell people what's awesome about being a four. Like, what should the universe appreciate about fours? I mean, are we always walking around with berets reading Baudelaire and being completely depressed, or are we fun, or what is redeemable about fours? And also, by the way, reminding you just to say your name into the mic when you talk.
This is Don.
Thank you for the FM voice. We appreciate that.
Hi, this is Don.
I would say that when my wife and I thought we were both fours, and Ian was the one that said, so talk to me a little bit about this both fours thing. And we talked for a while, and then you said, well, let me read something to you. Tell me if this sounds right. And it was just like, what was that you just read? That is my wife. And it was a five. And I went home. You told me not to go tell her this right away. I did anyway. And but I said it gently, uncharacteristically.
No, you didn't. You kicked
gently.
The door in and
yeah,
you said,
oh,
you
my
God,
not
you're
going to believe what I found out about you. Anyway.
Got your number.
Yeah, literally. So, but she was actually, I think I really did accomplish some measure of a nuance in this case, and she was open to it, and it turned out to really be true. And then she said, so I think it was the next day, so if I'm a five and you're a four, does that bum you out? I was like, no, now I'm the only four in the family. So, and I will also say that I feel like I regularly cannot identify other fours because I just assume I'm the only one, is my suspicion about that. So yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's great is that it's especially if we're around when the bleep goes down, fours are really beneficial to be there. The default position is to live through suffering internally. Mm-hmm. So when the suffering comes from an external place, from some event, it's not a surprise in a way. And I think that we a lot of times can have a presence and a calming factor and an ability to reassure people that all the crazy feelings they suddenly are in touch with are not un, uncommon and that they're okay, that feeling all these things is okay.
So a empathy, comfort. Right? There's that the
and
gift
a,
of,
and a consoling presence, I think.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. I don't think anything surprises fours. Like if you it like I always tell people, you could come to my house and tell me like mm-hmm. some horrible fact about your life. Mm-hmm. And I won't blink. I'll just be like, yeah, it happens. Right. Life is hard. And you can just hang out here and let it be hard with me. I'm cool. I can do it. That's
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Without needing to fix you. But okay, so for you guys, Megan, how does empathy work in your life? Like in your context, what that gift of empathy that fours
yeah,
have?
I think two ways. At work, it works for me in that I'm really good at resolving interpersonal issues and seeing beneath whatever the presenting problem is, which happens all the time. Sometimes I feel like my work as a leader is sort of like counseling in disguise, you know, which I know is true for me as a leader when I've had other people do that for me, you know, that we bring our personal issues to work, and very often those are the things that are in the way. And so my ability to see beneath things and empathize helps me to guide my team and connect with them at a level that is kind of abnormal, I think, in a normal, you know, work context. So that's huge. At home, I have four children, as you know, two of whom are my stepkids, two are adopted from Uganda. And my little guys have had a lot of trauma. And so that has enabled me to step into their journey of healing in a way that's probably the most profound way that I've entered suffering outside of my own personal story. And I think I just have a lot of capacity. You know, I just feel like I can really go get in it with them. And I'm not afraid of their pain, you know, kind of like what Don was saying, the ability to sit with people in suffering, in trauma, is a real gift. And in my own life, that's been hugely helpful as a mother and as a leader of a company.
Sandra, do you find, I mean, I know a bunch of your incredible songs. Do you find in your music that one of the things that happens is that your ability, natural ability as a four to empathize works itself out in your music, that people listening to your music would say, she gets it, like she knows what it's like to be me? Or I mean, is that a goal that's maybe not, you know, you're not thinking of it, but it ends up being it?
Yeah, maybe the goal is depth in that, you know. What I would want is for it to feel like it has that richness and it has depth. And on one hand, I don't, I think you mentioned earlier about four's ability to like imagination, like the fours have a capacity for imagination. So coupled with the ability to be present. So to be so present where I feel like when I'm in a moment, it's the only thing I've ever felt. It's the only thing I'm ever going to feel. Right. So being so there's just like cavernous space in the moment, the present moment. And that can be a real liability sometimes, but it's a real gift in terms of friendship or sitting with somebody. It's also, I think, in whatever form of expression, I think it can be really also a gift just to be present. The downside would be that you can't, like, I don't plan ahead. I don't think about what's going to happen down the road. I'm just like so in it right now. And when that moment passes, I'm so relieved. Like, oh my gosh, the sun came out, you know? And yet I think being present and seeing that as a gift for, like for ourselves and for the people around us, I think it can be, something that leads.
Mm. So. Yeah. So, Matthew, let me ask you a question. We struggle in relationships, we fours, and maybe that's such a hallmark feature for us is this abandonment and loss theme, which can get us into real trouble. Tell me a little bit about the four journey in relationships. Like, even maybe speak to people who are in relationship with fours, like, you know, like, what's it like? And like, how do you survive?
We're sorry.
Yeah. Lots of therapy.
Well, because more than any other number, this is where we're a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is where we're a lot of work.
Well, when you figured out my wife was a five, you said, I can think of one word to describe her. Tired.
Well, yeah, because that's the one word, intent. Fours can be very intense and very, like...
But what does that mean, intense?
Well, like, I think emotionally intense. Fours want to go into that emotional territory that's, you know, below the surface, right, and actually way below the surface oftentimes, you know. And I think fours want, I speak for myself, like I've always, in any situation with a friend or even a new person, that I've had to learn over the years how to temper this. And when I first moved here, I had a friend that was just like, you can't do small talk. Like, you got to learn how to do small talk. Like, and I did learn the value of being able to sort of exchange what feels like sort of just petty, sort of everyday stuff that bores me the tears. Mm. But I learned that you have to earn your way in with people. And I used to be just like barged down the door and sort of like, you know, asking very, you know, sort of probably inappropriate questions about I didn't have a context for that. So I think fours have a tendency to want to dive deep very quickly. And so I think, whereas that can be good, because the desire behind that is to know another deeply and to know the parts that aren't just sort of the surface, the sort of personas that we wear, you know, to kind of get, and I would say I've always been obsessed with the shadowy parts, you know, I kind of, that's where I want to go to right away. Mm. I kind of, where's the dark stuff? Okay, let's go there. I gravitate to it. And so I think in one way it can be intense emotionally. And so I think fours, you know, I think in a healthy way to learn how to temper that process of getting there. Not that you don't get there, but I think too, the good things are, you know, I think fours can be very imaginative and creative and spontaneous and can be very exciting, you know, I think in their creativity in a relationship. And I think, also in the same way of that empathy, you know, to be able to be a partner to somebody who can carry their, darker parts a little, with some understanding and empathy and grace. So I think there's value there. So when you do get to that dark part, you know, there's some willingness and ability to sort of carry that and sit with it and be in it, you know? So I think those are positive parts of relationships with fours.
One other person, high side of being a four.
This is Megan talking. We make things really beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if there were no fours, there would be so much less art and music and good food and maybe wine. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that. But, you know, we make the world rich and beautiful and deep and create, I think, places for people to be known and loved and feel safe. And if that wasn't in the world, it would be sad. Mm. I also think we can be funny and we probably don't get credit for that sometimes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, I think that there's like a, I don't know. I don't know if it's like the high side or if it's just kind of the counterbalance to the darkness, but there's some funny going on in some fours,
for sure.
You know? Like, we were cracking tons of jokes before we started talking about being fours, and then we all got kind of melancholy.
So what's interesting is, in a way, the dark space creates the natural climate in which irony emerges. And I think that's what I think about with humor. It's not just humor, ha, ha, ha. Right. It's this sort of sense of irony.
Yes.
An angle on the world that others don't see. And then when you say it, their eyes kind of bug open for a second. They go, oh, yeah, that's it. You
know? Yeah, it's like a deep connection, because a real, like, from the gut kind of laugh is something that it's costly. Mm. And how do you get to that point? And I think that was not a word you use necessarily, Matthew, but like, not just the desire to go deep, but to connect, like such an incredible desire to connect, which can wear people out. I think it can also be refreshing, and other people, I think, don't always know what to do with it, but I think that on the flip side of it, the humor, even in this room, is like, this is like, it feels like it's that kind of laughter when you're able to do it.
I think about that line in Pierce Pettis' song, You Move Me. You go whistling in the dark, making light of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that picture of the, I think fours in the positive sense, are because they know that terrain really well, it can be navigated with some lightness, you know, there's less fear of it. And so I think in a healthy way, when you're a healthier, you know, version of a four or whatever, you're able to sort of walk lightly in the dark, so to speak. And I think with people too, I think that's the value we bring in relationship is the ability to go, oh no, I know this pretty well.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Like, and I think that's a beautiful thing to be able, I for some reason I have this like a tour guide who's like, knows this terrain of like, that seems, it's kind of scary and unfamiliar and, you know, but they know it so well and you're kind of walking with them and they're like, no, this is good. This just leads right around here. And, you know, I think we can be sort of those tour guides through the darker terrains in a way that in a healthy way can be really light, you know?
Yeah. I remember saying to someone, it's just depravity. And the other thing I would say is I think there's also the I think shame, you know, which is a core part of how fours relate to the world. What you were talking about earlier, Ian, about how we're not easily shocked. I think that there's a tendency to be really aware of the shame that other people feel and to want them not to have to contend with that.
Yes.
And to make yourself someone who can absorb it so that when they tell you their most shameful thing, that it's, you know, lack of reaction. There's this kind of like,
that's all you got.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like, and like you say, and shame, and also I think grief, like the kind of grief or panic maybe that comes from sadness or fear or even anger. The idea of like, well, that's okay. It's just anger. It's just sadness. It's just fear. And there always has been and always will be plenty of that. And so we can be here in it together and it'll all work out all right. And I think that aspect, when you were talking about what's good about fours and what's good in relationships about fours, is their capacity to absorb the anxiety in a system when it comes to those kinds of things.
But we also have to be careful, because that's the key defense mechanism of fours, introjection.
Yes.
When they come into a room, if they pick up on any negative energy, anything dark in the space, they actually bring it somehow or another. They see themselves as the ground zero of it. Like somehow or another, they just sort of go, oh, this must be my fault. Like I've never met a four who doesn't say, oh, something went wrong in a relationship. 100% my fault.
Oh, jeez. So
for sure. And also, like, if not that, you're walking into a room with a bunch of strangers and you sense that energy, you go, what I do is internally rehearse it till I get myself to a place where, oh, I'm familiar with that energy within me. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Like, even if I couldn't have been my fault, but I'm like this, aren't I?
You know? Yeah. All right. So, Sandra, going back to this relationship thing, this is that push-pull dance. I mean, we idealize. Idealization is a huge thing for fours, right? So we see somebody and we idealize them and we just, I mean, it's a love bomb. It's like, but kind of a needy love bomb, unlike the two, which is like, I got to meet your needs. It's more like, no, you're actually going to meet my needs. You're actually going to complete me. Oh my gosh, you're the ideal that I've been looking for my whole life. And then just as fast, we run away. You know what I mean? We run in, we run out. We run in, we run out. So in relationships, has that been a dynamic for you? Or, I mean, it sure has been for me. In my marriage of 30 years, my wife would say, yes, you do that on a weekly basis.
Yeah,
and
right.
You rush in, there's this intensity, and then you rush out, and you're critical and moody and broody, and I don't know, maybe I just answered the question of all the fours in the room, but has that been a dynamic for you?
Well, I mean,
there's a lot. Fours laughing about their own junk.
Here. Yeah.
Where's the exit?
There's no exit.
Yeah, right.
I don't know.
You'll still be with yourself when you go out the door.
Yeah, wherever you go, that's where you'll be.
Oh man, it's probably I've experienced such growth in the last 4 or 5 years in community, like in being in close relationship with a lot of different friends. And I think in that I've recognized that like with a good friend who's a six, she was telling me, she was actually Leslie that was on this same conversation. She was just telling me, you know, when a six withdraws, they're not going anywhere. Right. But they're withdrawing in a way that's like, I need to figure something out. But when a four feels that, it's like, oh, well, that must be abandonment. So I think for me, the struggle is to that I don't know where that comes from, honestly. I mean, I can point to some things, but it is so early and so fundamental to who I am is to think like, if somebody withdraws or is not happy, it's not just people pleasing. It's like somewhere deep in there, there's something that that I'm afraid I'm being left, you know? And I think...
And then do you run? Do you make a run for it when you feel it?
Maybe. I usually stay and suffer, honestly.
I try to beat them to the punch.
That's true. Like, yeah, a little cat and mouse.
You can't abandon me. I'll abandon you first.
Yeah, right. But right. I will say that, like, that in the last 4 or 5 years, it's the way I've started to understand it is around the way I've been able to even put words to that is that it's coming out in prayer for me is to basically realize somewhere fundamentally I'm afraid God has left or is going to leave.
Oh my gosh.
And so if that's not reconciled or dealt with, and I think I'm understanding that it's not going to be dealt with like in one fell swoop, but it's going to be a progressive. Mm-hmm. But that when I go to that place of prayer that's beneath the relational drama that I've usually created, that beneath there's the question of like, God, are you leaving? Like, did you leave? Mm-hmm. And always the answer is no.
Yeah.
Always the answer is I'm here.
Yeah.
And so I think as that part heals, it kind of heals from the inside out. And, there's great hope in that. And there's also like perpetual like question marks because all the stuff on the surface will continue to, you know. And I think I need that. I mean, as a parent, like with my two kids that are 9 and 10, it's like they're starting to push into new independence at this stage. And it's the same thing like you described, Matthew, that like I know they will leave. I mean, the idea is for them to leave. That's what I want for them. So how to to address that core abandonment stuff while leaning into being able to be present with them, but also not to like grasp for that relationship. So it plays out in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. But
so one of the things that people ask me constantly at Enneagram workshops is you'll hear someone will raise their hand and go, I have a 4 child. I have a child who's a 4. I just realized that. And oftentimes they just have tears running down their face because they're like, oh my gosh, I thought this kid was, you know, from another planet, you know, and I've not known how to relate to them or how to deal with them. And, you know, I just want, if you could, in 1 or 2 sentences, because in the interest of time, like, what would you tell a parent like this to do or not to do with a kid who's a 4 based on your experience growing up?
The tendency is to
Don,
try to...
Tell them you're Don.
I'm Don.
Yes.
The tendency is to try to micromanage the externals. I think the tendency as a parent with a 4 is to think, if I fix this circumstance or that circumstance, maybe this howling ache this kid seems to be... Or drama, right? Mm. Feeling and expressing. Maybe then that'll go away. Case in point, when my dad made me cut my hair when I was... And it was like, ugh. It was, you know... For me, it was like some sort of eradication of identity, and it became this like major grudge. It was not a helpful step in our relationship. I don't know, out of fairness to my dad, I'm not sure that's what he was looking for.
Right.
But so I think there's a tendency to major on the minors with 4s when you're parenting them. You have to like take a deep breath, recognize that all the feelings that they feel are just feelings. And so what's really happening, and then I think secondarily, be there when they're done. That's one of the biggest things that my wife has talked about. I think it was one of the things you said in the book, maybe. This idea of just, they 4s have the need sometimes to just rant about all these things. Not rant, maybe rant, but whatever. Express all this stuff. And then the most important thing is just to be there when they're done. You don't have to render an opinion or a judgment. In fact, oftentimes they know a lot about what it is they're feeling. They don't need somebody to tease it out for them very often, sometimes. But the best thing is just be there when they're finished, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. then they're not abandoned.
How about you, Matthew? What would you tell a parent of a 4, like just advice, what would you tell them?
I mean, that's really good. A lot of that is stuff I would agree with. And I think... to play on one of those points, though, that I had a similar experience with a haircut mm-hmm. when I was a kid, and I think things that would almost cause one to exaggerate their individualism are the times when that is violated in a certain way. Is that making any sense? Like, in other words, the things that could probably make an unhealthy or a sort of militant four, you know, in their fourness, is to sort of not allow what you're talking about in a way of
individual expression.
Yeah, because at some point it's like it almost galvanizes even more. I've got to be this militant individualist. And I don't think that's altogether healthy necessarily. I think that's usually in reaction to some kind of suppression or lack of allowance of that space, or not having the space to sort of be to process this internal life that's going on, and not. I mean, you said it really well. I'm just playing off that idea that tending to and understand. You just said it very well. Like, just allowing space for that. To process.
Yeah, you know, something about what you're saying though makes me realize how much of it is the feeling that you've been abandoned in that moment.
Right.
That your true essence, right, whatever it is that's true about you, has been undercut by somebody thinking you're something else. Yeah. And right. So I think that's the
right.
That's something.
Abandoned or shamed in that. Yeah, yeah. Like, there's right. some shame around that you feel that way, or you feel that much, or you feel right. whatever it is. Like right. that. If we're not assigning, if there's no shame attached to that, I think that helps one develop a more healthy way of being in that in that sort of makeup, you know. Lack of shame in those things, and holding space for things that maybe some don't quite understand, or don't really have don't feel they have the capacity to be with, maybe even. But to just, I think that's a great thing. It's just allowing space and being there at the end of it. It's wonderful.
Great. Sandra, how about you? What would you tell a parent of a four to like remember to do with a kid who's a four?
I have a real aversion to, if I were the kid, I'm putting myself in the center of this question. Sorry. But if I were the kid, I have a real aversion to anything that feels superficial or rigid. So just rules, just to have rules. I think what I want so much is understanding and presence.
Yes.
So if there's something that feels like the parent's response would be like superficial, like just even just real like niceness, I mean, it just makes me like want to rebel, you know, because I want connection and I want understanding. And even if I can't have that, I don't want to be fixed. So I think thinking about that with children, clearly there's a lot of mess. There's going to be a lot of that's like disordered for a while, where it's like that idea, Augustine talking about disordered loves. I mean, that is definitely still us as adults, but how much more as children when they're trying to figure out what are the loves and how do I put them in order? So just coming alongside in that, I think as a parent is like, there's just a lot of space for creative presence giving, right? Like instead of just rule giving or just platitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
cool. Great. Megan, finish up for us. What would you tell? And this could also, by the way, go for friends, you know, in general too. Sure. So relationships.
So my daughter is
spouses,
a four.
Yes. Yeah.
I have a four daughter and I am a four, which is interesting to kind of, you know, think through. But a big thing that I would say to parents is don't try to manage the feelings. Don't try to intercept them, minimize them, spin them, make them more positive than they are, you know,
condescend,
you know, anything like that, because I think it either invalidates, and then like you guys were saying, it kind of makes the feelings bigger. It makes the fourness bigger, or it can drive them underground because the shame thing kicks in. And it's just that, you know, I definitely felt this at times as a child. I'm the oldest of five, and my poor parents, have your first kid be a four is a lot. but to feel like, you know, I'm just too much emotionally. I'm just too much. And so I need to kind of suppress that, you know. So I would say those two aspects are important to consider.
Anthony, my engineer, who's got a four.
Yeah, so my youngest is a four, daughter, and I think one of the things that's been really powerful for us as we've been raising her is to let her know that her wiring is a gift to herself, and a gift to the world around her. In an immediate sense, that means she's a gift to us and our family. And so I think when you touch higher highs and lower lows, we celebrate that. And I think when she has permission to go there, then you are able to bring back treasure from those places, you know? You're able to bring back beauty from the highs and from the lows. Mm-hmm. And then also, okay, if you're going to go an extra minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes, then you need to go to your room. If you need to keep emoting or keep exploring what you're feeling, you can't take us all through that journey right now. So go
because,
and do it in your room.
There are hot dogs on the grill.
Right. Go and do it in your room and then come back when you're ready to join the rest of us. So yeah.
That's good.
That might take 6 or 7 hours, but that's cool. Do what you got to do, you know?
Well, y'all, this has been such a rich conversation, and I know because we're fours that we could go on for hours because there's nothing more than we want them to be understood by other people, even though that's a fool's errand for us. It's not going to happen. You know, if you are a four, let me just give you a couple of sort of growth path suggestions. You know, really the big thing we have to work on is equanimity. How do we let whatever life throws at us not throw us into emotional turmoil? I love how the Buddhists describe this, which is, you know, you are not the waves, you're the ocean. You are not the clouds, you are the sky. You are not the weather, you are the mountain. And it takes it's taken me a long time to figure that out because, man, I was just whatever I was feeling. That's what I was, you know. I would say another thing that I think fours have to do that isn't really talked about enough is get back into our bodies. We are so in our imaginations, so far into our feelings, that doing things like yoga, so good for us. Massage, I think, is really good for fours. I think running, anything that gets us back grounded, feet on the earth. I have a body. I am not free floating in this kind of, you know, pool, this slur of feelings that are wandering around. I think just being okay with ordinary, practicing ordinary. So I oftentimes tell people, you know, like, you know, you don't have to shop at that Korean market that's 45 minutes away from your house because it's got that particular thing that you need. I'm like, you know, discipline yourself not even to go to Whole Foods every now and then. Like, go find yourself a Kroger and, you know, buy some stuff. You know what I mean? Buy some stuff there that has stuff that your grandmother wouldn't recognize on the label, just as a discipline, you know. And then maybe a last thing is, you know, we're always so focused on what's missing. In other people, the moment we walk in a room. Now, unlike ones who walk in a room and see what's wrong, we know what's missing. And our attention migrates to it so quickly. Now, of course, that can be a gift. You know, any of these things can be gifts if they're redeemed. But to in the moment to stop and go, okay, yeah, so there's no, you know, if I walk in a room, sometimes I go, I'll say something to myself like, what are these people allergic to color? You know, and or whatever it is, you know what I mean? Like, I notice what's missing and then I go, yeah, but what's present? Yeah. What's here? Like, what's here right now? And then sometimes I just encourage fours to maybe as a couple of mantras, you know, or little things, sort of totems you can write around the house or whatever, put on a bracelet of somehow or another that reminds you of different disciplines, is just that, you know, remind yourself nothing's missing. Like, actually everything you need to be happy is here right now. It's not out there in some distant future, that what we need for happiness is here right now. So those are some growth path transformational kinds of tips for fours. Megan, thank you for bringing your perspective, and
thank you for having me.
Yeah, how cool. I'm so glad you were here. And Sandra, to you, thanks for bringing your heart and your spirit and your story to us today.
Thank you.
Matthew, as always, second time this year, man.
I feel very special.
You are very special. You are.
Thank
and
you
Don,
for having me.
My brother, my Home Depot, let's talk
that's
about
right.
our suicidal fathers
oh, yeah.
guy.
That's nothing
friend.
Better.
Nothing better than being able to do that. Brother. Anthony Skinner, my producer, my engineer, yeah. another four on the Enneagram. Everybody out there, don't forget my friend Michael Cusick. at restoringthesoul.com. If you want to get a hold of a great therapist to spend a half a day block, or go down to Denver, Colorado, spend a week or 2 weeks with him to do some work on your marriage or on who you are as a person, he is the guy to do it, and I'm not fooling. You could call Mike at 303-932-9777, 303-932-9777, and if you're a Typology listener, you can visit www.restoringthesoul.com/typology to download a PDF of my favorite reading, 5 Ways Trauma May Be Derailing Your Relationships. All right, here we go. Right. We're going to sing For the Times They Are A-Changing, because we're a group of fours trying to leave here in a good spirit. Until next week, remember the words of the great Oscar Wilde: be yourself. Everybody else is already taken. Here we go. Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come, writers and critics, prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing. Senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. Oh, come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters, they're beyond your command, and your old road is rapidly aging. So get out of the new one if you can't lend a hand. Oh, the times, they are a-changing. The line has been drawn, the curse has been cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order rapidly fading, and the first one